This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Writer Alan First is obsessed with the years 1938 to 1941. All of First's espionage novels are set in Europe during those years of Nazi horror, fleeing refugees, and shifting political alliances. Not quite thrillers, First novels deal more with the day-to-day realities and the moral compromises people make in times of war. Reviewers often compare him to Graham Greene, Somerset Maugham, and John le Carré. First was a reporter for the International Herald Tribune and a freelance journalist before he switched to fiction. His books include Night Soldiers, Dark Star, The World at Night, and now his new spy novel, Kingdom of Shadows. It's about Nicholas Morath, a Hungarian aristocrat who fought in the First World War. He's an advertising agent by day and a spy for the Hungarian resistance by night. I asked Alan First to read from this passage from his new book, Kingdom of Shadows.
Maybe it was the war. He was not the same when he came back. He knew what people could do to each other. It would have been better not to know that. You lived a different life if you didn't know that. He had read Eric Maria Remarque's book, All Quiet on the Western Front, 3 or 4 times, and certain passages again and again. It read, "Now, if we go back, we will be weary, broken, burnt out, rootless, and without hope. We will not be able to find our way anymore. Let the months and the years come. They bring me nothing. They can bring me nothing. I am so alone and so without hope that I can confront them without fear." A German book. Morath had a pretty good idea what Hitler was mining in the hearts of the German veterans. But it was not only about Germany. They had all, British, French, Russian, German, Hungarian, and the rest, been poured into the grinding machine, where some of them died, and some of them died inside themselves. Who, he wondered, survived? But whoever did, he didn't know. The point was to get up in the morning, to see what might happen, good or bad, a red-black wager. But, even so, a friend of his used to say, it was probably a good idea that you couldn't commit suicide by counting to 10 and saying now.
Alan First reading from his new book, Kingdom of Shadows. Alan First, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think the most interesting thing about your spies, and really it's all true of all spies, is that they have to make decisions in which the choices are all complicated and compromised morally. They're really no good choices, and they're all bad. You either work for Stalin to keep Hitler at bay, or you have to bargain with SS officers who want to oust Hitler in order to advance your cause. All of the shifting alliances that come along with a world at war, that there's no way out of that.
That's really the essence of these books, what I sometimes think of as the realpolitik of daily life. In a situation that people found themselves in the late 30s and early 40s.
Now, why have you written about the 30s, specifically 1938 to 1941, in 4 books now? What is it about the 30s that your imagination seems to live there?
I can't stop. the thing I like about it is that in that particular period of years, there were so many substantive political shifts that people found themselves on the wrong side of the fence without ever moving. It was the fence that moved. And that occasions a kind of drama of life because no one knew what was going to happen next, and everything continued to change around them so that right became left and negative became positive and friend became enemy, and everything changed during that period. So that when you put characters into that kind of heated situation, you get a lot of action, you get behavior, you get choices that have to be made, you get to see what people are really like.
Well, the bits of anecdotes and stories from this time is really what grounds your books, makes them so real, especially about refugees. And I'm thinking of one story about German Jews who make it to New York in 1937. They're at Ellis Island, and a well-dressed man offers to buy their clothes. Can you tell that story? Is it true?
Sure. It is a true story. And the OSS did do that. I believe they did it a little later than 1937 because they didn't precisely come into being until around 1942. So I moved the time a little bit. But basically what happened was you can't send a secret agent into Austria wearing a Brooks Brothers suit. They needed clothing, and the refugees were astonished not only to be paid for the poor things that they managed to have on their backs when they came out of Europe, but had their clothing replaced as well. I'm sure the wiser of them also understood exactly what was going on.
Some, though, must have thought they'd arrived to paradise.
Yeah, that's right.
Place where people buy your dirty clothes and
right.
Streets are paved with gold.
Streets were paved with gold, that's right.
Now, did you do oral histories to research these books?
Not per se oral histories, but I talked to a lot of people when I was living in Europe, and everyone has a story. Everyone has a story about their parents or about an uncle or a relative or someone they knew who lived, who died, who made it out, who didn't make it out, who made it as far as the Swiss frontier. And that was very interesting. And I think that all goes into the books in some form or another. And one of the thing that really goes into the books is the fact that quite literally everybody has a story about the period. It's very much alive in Europe, even today.
Do you have a story, a personal story?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
You're the one. That's why you tell them, I guess.
For some reason, I've taken it upon myself to tell these stories and to write about these people. And in fact, of course, they've written magnificently about themselves. If you read Arthur Kessler, if you read Joseph Roth, émigrés wrote books about being émigrés, about the psychology of it, about the feeling of it, about what became of them. There are many of them. And many people rose to magnificent writing on the occasion.
Joseph Roth is a writer whose funeral you depict in this book.
True, as it was, as it happened, in the village of Thiers, which is just outside of Paris, on the day that it took place.
Well, he had a tragic story.
Oh, terrible story. He was born in a shtetl in Galicia, converted to Catholicism, became a royalist, fought in the Austro-Hungarian army, finally had to run in 1933 when Hitler rose to power in Germany, saying to a friend as he ran, "One always flees from a burning house." That was his line about it. He then went to Paris and proceeded basically to drink himself to death, and died of drink, really, in 1939, I believe. I hope I have that right. He did his drinking in a bar called the Tournon. I have a photograph of it, actually. And that was his story. And along the way, he wrote magnificent books about exile. He wrote, his famous book is The Radetzky March, which I recommend to everybody. It's a wonderful book about the period and about the way people were during the period. Flight Without End, he wrote, also very good.
Talking about him, it sounds as if you have a very personal connection to him.
I feel a personal connection to him. I have a drawing of him on the wall. And sometimes I feel like... at least I want to try to finish some of the books that he never got to write. You get a sense during the World War II period, which is to say 33 to 44, of unfinished work, of paintings unpainted, novels unwritten, poems unwritten. And I think that's part of what got me to start writing these books in the first place.
I'm talking with novelist Alan Furst. He writes spy novels set in the Nazi era. His new book is Kingdom of Shadows. Alan, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is spy novelist Alan Furst. His new book is Kingdom of Shadows. I think you started writing spy novels right when they were really considered dead. Cold
That's
War
me.
Is over. Completely out of fashion.
I think so. But, you know, it's a funny thing. I was wondering what kind of novel you could write about the period. And the thing about spy novels is that at least some of the characters can be immensely knowing and totally aware of certain things, of certain information that they would never know in a different kind of book, so that you can always gloss the political situation or the diplomatic situation. You can always have characters making correct predictions about the future or incorrect predictions about the future. But you can always show what people felt at the time, since people in that world, by definition, have to be very, very sensitive to that.
Well, you were a journalist in the beginning of your writing career. You'd also written a couple of novels set in contemporary times. What got you on to espionage?
Well, in a way, the difference between an espionage novel and a murder mystery, which is what I'd written earlier, is that an espionage novel allows room for such sophistication, comparatively speaking, political sophistication. It allows for more international point of view. It allows people to be in different countries. It's just a wider band.
I think as a reporter for Esquire, you were on assignment to write a story about a boat trip down the Danube, right?
And
I understand that your wife took you to the airport, and later when you came back, she said that the man she dropped off at the airport never came back.
That's true.
And that, shortly after that, you began writing spy novels.
That's true.
What happened
to me was this. I meant for on assignment from Esquire only to go to the Danube Delta, which begins in Romania. But at that time, the Soviet Union controlled that little part of the world. And they insisted that you go to Moscow and spend rubles, and then spend rubles to fly on Aeroflot, and then spend some more rubles in a hotel in Simferopol, and then spend some more rubles on a passenger freighter that went across the Black Sea. Well, you didn't have a choice, so I did what they said you had to do, and landed in Moscow September 1st, 1983, right in the middle of the moment when the Korean airliner had just been shot down, and people in the streets were shifting their eyes to heaven in expectation of incoming rockets, which were not incoming, and I knew they weren't, not over this.
Rockets from the Americans.
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. And there was, I had never been in a totalitarian country before. And there was, at the time, Ronald Reagan was carrying on about the evil empire, and I think a lot of people shrugged and took it with a grain of salt, but he was right on the money. That is precisely what it was, and it was evil. But I didn't know how it was evil until I was there. And the way it was evil in that people lived completely under a police state. Every act, everything they said to people, every moment of their day was basically controlled or observed. And that's a very difficult way to live life, and that shows in people. It shows in their faces. It shows in the way they walk. It shows in the way they move around a city. And I was very, very sensitive to it.
What struck you in their eyes and in their faces and the way they walk?
They were scared. They got up in the morning trying to deal with a government that basically said to them, "What have you done for me today? And if it's the right thing, maybe you can have dinner." That's kind of the way that state functioned. It still may function that way. But basically, they were scared.
What made you identify so intimately with the people in Moscow? You don't speak Russian, right?
I do not speak a word of Russian. Maybe do svidaniya I speak. That's it. You've heard it. But essentially, one of the things that hit me was that they were people that in a funny sense I recognized. They were not unlike people that I had grown up with on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. They had similar body language. The faces were not dissimilar. And in a strange way, because my family comes from there, I had come to a place that was not in any sense home, but that was home at one time to my family. And you could just barely still make that connection in the middle 80s.
So when your wife says that a different person came back from this trip, what does she mean? What had changed?
What had changed was I was very angry at the way these people were treated. It was unjust. It was unfair. And it stimulated that part of me that writes novels. And I determined that I would sit down and write novels about this. And that was the worthwhile thing to write about, and it meant a lot to me. And suddenly I was a completely different writer and perhaps somewhat of a different person in that I felt now a kind of mission to say what went on and what went on in the past in this part of the world, which meant everywhere from France all the way over to Moscow.
So that part of you that writes novels is a political part or an angry, angry part?
It's an angry poet. I don't know how to put it any better than that. It's someone who feels that life probably ought to be lived in a decent way, that people should have as much happiness as they can get, and that when you add secret police and all the apparatus of that kind of state, it just makes life a great deal more difficult. So I guess in a way, I was writing about that, but it shouldn't be thought that I'm a political writer. These are entertaining books. I want them to be entertaining books, and basically, they follow a lot of the genre format. And whatever else may be true is encapsulated, and it's there for the reader if the reader wants it.
While you were writing your first spy novel, Night Soldiers, you left the country with your wife, and you moved to Paris.
Correct.
What were you looking for in Paris?
I noticed that I could live in Paris. That's a funny way to say it. But in fact, we were living in a place called Bainbridge Island, Washington. We were somewhat bored living there after a number of years. And we went, let's go and live in Paris. I can do what I do in Paris just as well. My wife left behind a career as a landscape designer and then immediately became a landscape designer in Paris. When I asked her about, before we left, I said, how are you going to feel about this? She said, well, I'll feel terrible not doing what I do anymore, and I'll probably cry. And she paused for a beat and then said, but I'll be crying in Paris.
Did you figure in an idea about writing that you have to soak up the aura of a place in order to write novels that are set in Europe?
I had lived in Europe before that, and I thought that might happen, but it wasn't so particularly that. I simply wanted to live abroad. I liked living abroad. I'd lived abroad earlier. And it did work, however, just precisely the way you suggest, in that you turn certain street corners in Paris and you're in 1938.
Do you come upon ideas for your next novel in the course of your research for one?
And, absolutely.
And you have examples of that?
Yes, because when you read about one country in one period, by definition, you're reading about other times and places. And my plots basically propose themselves by stories told in books that I'm reading. That's really where they come from. I believe I was working on the French resistance when it became clear to me, for example, that the Polish resistance had a full-fledged intelligence service operating. And the Polish officer, my next book after Dark Star, was a result of that. And Kingdom of Shadows was based on really an observation of a map that I was using for my previous book, which was called Red Gold. I noticed that war did not come to Hungary until 1944, and I thought, how did they do that? At first I thought it was an accident, and then I began reading and discovered it was no accident at all, that the Hungarians had tried desperately to keep away from the conflagration, and they had done it in a very clandestine kind of way, and the story of what they tried to do is told in Kingdom of Shadows.
I'm curious if there's more information coming out from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union that you use in your research.
All the time. It's very interesting. They keep writing books about the period. They keep making revelations about the period. A lot of the stories from that time just won't die because the truth about them has never been told. For example, the story about Raoul Wallenberg. It's back for the umpteenth time and told again, and the Russians this time are saying, well, here's the truth. This is absolutely what happened. Now we're going to tell you, you know, for the final time. But I bet that isn't true. I bet you more will be told in time. So, yes, I do read those books, and I read them with great interest.
Do you have a new book?
I'm working on a new book, which is about the Black Sea. It's about Odessa. It starts out in Istanbul. Of course, it will go to Paris, as all my books do, because it's Paris is, in a funny way, the heart of Europe at that time, and it's also the heart of these books. So, yes, I am working on it. It's about Russian emigres and their particular fate in 1940, 1941, as, again, the boundaries changed and alliances changed.
Alan First, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alan First's new book is Kingdom of Shadows. This is Fresh Air.